We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Aikman is intercepted by Sam Mills.
Steve Smith is going to go all the way. Panthers win in overtime.
Newton steps up, goes for the end zone. Olsen, touchdown. Brian Burns to the house.
This one is picked again. Intercepted by Boston.
Bridgewater, throw into the end zone. Touchdown.
Samuel still on his feet inside the five to the end zone. Touchdown. What a play.
And it is caught for the touchdown by Moore.
And in the foot race, McCaffrey to the end zone.
He pounded on three. 1, 2, 3.
He pounded.
All right. Welcome back to another edition of The Roar, a Carolina Panthers podcast right here on Blue Wire. John Ellis is my name, joined by my co-host Billy Marshall. We've got a big one today, folks. It's all about the Super Bowl. We're going to break it down. Billy and I haven't talked since the big game, so we're going to give you our analysis on what went down on Sunday and sort of foreshadow where Tampa is moving forward and where Carolina fits into that mix, because it is a very relevant conversation to be having right now. We're going to break down Carolina's offseason. But first, let's welcome in our special guest today, one of my favorite people on the planet. He's a great reporter. He does such great work for the Los Angeles Times, has been doing this for a long time, just covered another Super Bowl in Tampa, and we're going to get into that and much more. It's Sam Farmer from the Los Angeles Times. Sam, how you doing? Welcome to the Roar podcast on Blue Wire, and this is a thrill to have you, man. Thanks for making time.
Well, thanks so much, John. I'm doing well. I'm here in Pebble Beach, California. It's a gorgeous day, and I think it's going to rain tomorrow, but it's just a postcard day, cloudless here. And I just ran into Jim Nantz, and I told him I'm following you all around, so we're going to do lunch tomorrow.
Jim Nantz.
Pretty nice.
Yeah, that is Jim Nantz country, of course. You know, Pebble Beach is his home. And you've got a cherry gig, though. You're out there at Pebble Beach right after you went to one of the most fascinating Super Bowls, Sam, that I've ever seen. You know, I haven't seen them all, but I've seen a lot of them. What was the atmosphere like in a COVID world at the Super Bowl?
Yeah, John, it was surreal. From the moment I got there, it felt like sort of the neutron bomb Super Bowl, in that it was all the trappings of the Super Bowl in terms of the signage and the giant Lombardi trophy on the hotel and the, you know, you'd see the logo and some of the merchandise shops, but no people. And it was not until probably Friday afternoon that you started to see people show up. Typically in a Super Bowl, there's a throng of people early in the week, and then it expands, and it's a mass expanse of people by Thursday.
Right.
And so this was very different. And when you got near anything that was league controlled was very buttoned down. I mean, everybody at the league was wearing double masks. But in other situations, you'd go into a restaurant and nobody had a mask on. So it was a little strange, especially coming from California where people do mask up quite a bit. So, so that was different. And then the actual event, you know, with all the cardboard cutouts in the stands and the vaccinated workers who were there, and just the lengths the NFL went to space people out. And it was, I think it was 118 people in the press box where normally it was over 1,000. I think I want to say less than 10% of the typical media contingent. So that was really unusual. And you sort of had to do different things to add value, to sort of explain why you were there, because so much of it could be covered remotely.
I thought it was great with the cardboard cutouts, the way they spaced these out, because we've had seen that all year, of course, throughout stadiums, giving it a real full look. I thought it looked like a Super Bowl, and it certainly was dynamic.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. If you think of how far we've come in terms of moving off where we were before the season. Remember when Joe Buck, before the season, said, I think there's going to be fake noise, and people were apoplectic. You know, they thought, what? Fake noise? Now that's just standard issue. You're like, of course there's fake noise. And of course there are, you know, cutouts or simulated spectators. And those things that seem kind of normal now in this weird topsy-turvy world, not so long ago seemed completely outlandish that you would do that. So, you know, it's an altered reality that we've sort of grown used to.
Sam, thank you again for joining us this evening. You know, as you look back at these two teams and the way they've been constructed, whether it's through the draft or through free agency, to me, what stands out number one is the receiving cores of each team. Now we can discuss some of the kind of lesser known guys like a DeMarcus Robinson or Mecole Hardman, but for Kansas City, it's Kelsen Hill, and then obviously Tampa, their pass catchers, we don't have to go through them. But, you know, as you look into this offseason, usually like teams want to replicate an approach that championship teams usually have. Finding a Mahomes or Brady is easier said than done. So do you expect the league to potentially really kind of load up on finding elite pass catchers to really help the quarterback and the offense this offseason and the future?
Yeah, Billy. I mean, you do see the sort of copycat effect after a Super Bowl winner. And I think you're right that it's going to be tough to find quarterbacks like this. Obviously, it starts and ends with the quarterback. Well, I don't think it ends with the quarterback, but these teams, obviously, that's such a strength. But, you know, both these teams have guys who can stretch the field. And you mentioned Mecole Hardman and obviously Tyreek Hill and, you know, Scotty Miller. They're able to – both teams have guys who can kind of get vertical. Not every team has that. I saw a lot of Rams games this season. They don't have that player, but, you know, kind of difficult to replicate the success and the sort of weapon you have there at quarterback. Defensively, Kansas City came a long way this season and rounded into a solid defense. Certainly against the run and up front, I think there were, you know, Frank Clark and some of those players were really tough. And you had the best run defense in the league in Tampa Bay. But I definitely could see if you can assemble a receiving core like these teams have, that'd be a huge strength. I just think especially with the cap is going to come down a little bit. It's going to be tougher to keep people. And, you know, I don't know if it will be so easy to assemble the receiving corps like that.
Sam Farmer, LA Times, joins us right here on the Roar on Blue Wire. You can find his work, of course, at latimes.com. And he's a great Twitter follow, at LA Times Farmer. Sam, speaking of which, your article on Bruce Arians with his son. Let me just first of all say, I commented on this picture yesterday. Bruce in that chair and with that monster energy drink is just peak Bruce Arians, is it not? I just thought that was the best yeah. photo you guys could have laid out, by the way. That was great. But take me inside that room with Bruce Arians, one of the most fascinating figures in modern football, from my view. Just his sailor language, his ability to speak plainly, but also strategically, what a good mind he's had over the years. What insights did you gain talking to Bruce one-on-one right after his first Super Bowl win as a head coach?
Yeah, well, John, it was just, a really special experience, and one that, may never happen again, because just think, I mean, you're with a coach in his home hours after the Super Bowl. And this is, this is obviously the first Super Bowl in which a team played on its home field. So the coach would be out of town.
Sam, was that in his house or was that like a condo? Was that actually his house?
No, that was in his house.
That's remarkable.
That was in his house. Yeah. Yeah. No, I went over in the morning after the MVP press conference. I was invited over there, and I've known Bruce for many years, and it was just such a great moment. And so we played with his grandkids out in the front yard. I mean, he was doing that on Super Bowl Sunday as neighbors were driving by. He's got the Kangol on. He's instantly identifiable as Bruce Arians, and he's pushing his kid in the swing in the front yard, his grandson. And so we tossed the football around and then retired to the living room and just hung out there. He hadn't gone out to eat since July with his wife, but now he's been vaccinated. So he was looking forward to going out and getting a grouper sandwich at a favorite place he has on the water. So he's a man of the people, he wants to get out there and that's why he was upset about the parade situation, although they cleared a boat parade today.
What a scene that was. Really,
yeah, exactly.
Wow.
But it was terrific. We talked about all different kinds of things and laughed, and he told funny stories, funny things about the season. He talked about how Gronk, how this sort of bizarre season when they couldn't get together, the challenge of bringing a team together with a brand new quarterback, when you can't have meals together, you can't go out and bond together. A lot of your stuff is done virtually, so guys don't even know each other. And he said Gronk, and I thought this was so on brand for Gronk. He said Gronk doesn't even know the names of some of the guys on the team. So that's really funny. I just found that really funny. And here's a guy who was so instrumental, two touchdown catches in the Super Bowl. And so Bruce is just Bruce. He doesn't really worry about what he talks. He's just very candid, very unvarnished. And, it's PG-13 at least. Language. he's so endearing that way and disarming in how honest he is in a league where people are increasingly concerned about every word that they say. He just sort of tells it like it is, and he's not worried about it. So he talked about chewing out a team employee when sort of in the bluest language possible, and this guy came down in the elevator with Gronk, and it was the first day of camp, and the elevator said only one person in the elevator, and there were two, and so he swore them up and down and said, you idiots, basically, what are you doing? Last I checked, it said one person. There are two in the two of you in the elevator, and he was kind of yelling, and Gronk, he paused, and Gronk said, "Nice to meet you, coach." So, it was funny. Yeah. So, and, you know, he talked about Tom Brady and the practice schedule and how he's giving Brady time off and any number of things we talked about and how he had hoped to go play golf with Brady during the bye week, and they were going to hop in a plane and go up to Georgia to play golf, come back, get tested. But the league said no, and he really didn't like that at all. I mean, he really wanted to use that time to further bond with Brady. So he didn't pull any punches. And as I said, it was a unique experience. It was maybe once in a lifetime, because how often are you going to get a coach who's playing in his home city? And, you know, how often are you going to get a coach like Bruce Arians, who's just going to let loose? And so it was really cool. It was really a fun morning. And then I flew to Pebble Beach, and that's where I am right now. So it was a whirlwind day, but a great day.
You know, as you look forward to this offseason, there's going to be just a lot of movement, not only with quarterbacks. We're already seeing Orlando Brown request a trade. I'm sure there's other players who feel like there's going to be other player acquisition that are going to really kind of just light up Twitter and the NFL news. But what are you most looking forward to as we approach this offseason? Is it going to be the quarterback movement, obviously? Is it going to be how teams kind of structure, you know, how they're going to fit under the cap with it dropping a little bit this offseason? How do you anticipate teams really navigating this offseason?
Yeah, both of those things you mentioned, I think, are going to be fascinating. You know, sort of how teams fit under the cap. We've seen the cap go up and up and up, and to see it come down a little bit, we don't know by how much. But, you know, what does that mean in terms of retaining players or any big contracts? But really, you know, the numbers thing is, to me, is only really interesting in what players are available, what players can you afford, and what players are just going to be priced out. Are you going to be priced out of the market on? So I think the quarterback movement is going to be fascinating. And we've already seen some of it. And, you know, to see how Matt Stafford, for instance, who's never won a playoff game, how is he going to do in L.A. when he now finally has a running game, has a really good defense. And, you know, the Rams are not only competing with the rest of the NFC, but they've got somebody sharing their building who's got a rising superstar quarterback in Justin Herbert. Right. And so you're competing for the eyeballs in Los Angeles, the hearts and minds of L.A. So that will be really interesting. I'm interested in what happens to Jared Goff. You know, here's a guy who people might want to write off as a bust, but I don't think he's been a bust at all. He's got the second most wins of any quarterback during the last 4 years. They've made the playoffs three times. They got to the Super Bowl is his third year. You know, people were down on him this season, and he might not be the guy you put the game on his shoulders, but he's still a pretty good quarterback. I mean, I wouldn't say he's a top 10 quarterback, right. But I put him in maybe the top 20 quarterback. But you look at Derek Carr, he's coming off a phenomenal season. What's going to happen with him? Obviously, Deshaun Watson, where is he going? That's a huge question. Does he wind up in the AFC West with, you know, Oakland or Las Vegas, rather, or Denver? You know, what does Carolina do? What's their situation?
I'd like to get your thoughts on that, Sam, while we're on this topic. We have had quite a turbulent couple years here, gauging what this owner and what this new regime is trying to do. Teddy Bridgewater was brought in on a 3-year deal. Now it seems like Scott Fitterer, the new general manager, and the entire regime views that as something they're having second thoughts on. Let's just say that. In your view, how close was Carolina? We've seen some reporting on this. How close was Carolina to landing Stafford in this deal? What's your sense on Carolina's situation right now?
Well, I just back this up a little bit and just say that, I have extreme faith in Scott Fitterer. He's a guy I've known. I covered him when he was a high school kid. I know him as well as I know anybody in the league. He's one of my favorite people in the league, and really smart personnel guy. And I thought he was fantastic in Seattle and found a lot of those hidden gems. Now, they had hits and misses like anybody else, but I think the Panthers are in really good hands with Scott Fitterer. And that was a guy who had many opportunities to leave the Seahawks and didn't, was waiting for the right opportunity and took that. And so, I think they were right down to the wire in the Stafford Derby. And L.A., was willing to part. And I don't know what Carolina was willing to give up for Stafford, but right. The Rams' philosophy has been dealing with first round picks. You know, they haven't had a first round pick since 2016. They found some good players. The Cam Akers and the Cooper Kupps and the Gerald Everett and those players a little down the line in the draft. I'm not sure where Carolina is going to do with the quarterback position. There was, stability there and a star player there for many years. And, now it seems like they're going to go in a different direction, whether that's through the draft. So I think it remains to be seen. But I will say one thing that I know is that they've got a smart guy at the helm in Scott Fitterer.
We talked to Doug Farrar. I know you know Doug pretty well. Mm-hmm. He's done some great reporting on Seattle for a long time, of course, globally with the NFL. And Doug was of the same perspective that there was going to be a different mindset brought to Carolina than we've seen with Marty Herney, Dave Gettleman. It's a very new approach. And as we can already see, Scott Fitterer said they're going to be on an every deal. You know, some of this can be hyperbole, Sam, but they've already made calls. So it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. I'm intrigued to definitely see what happens next. Last question for you before we let you scoot and get back to the dulcet tones of Jim Nance and Pebble Beach, because that's where I'd like to be right now. What do you envision moving forward in this 2021 season globally? It's hard to predict with COVID. I've seen some of your posts, Sam, and I know California. I'm out here in South Carolina. It's an entirely different world on many levels, but this entire country continues to struggle with this pandemic, and the league is continuing to do their best to get these games played. As far as fans coming back, though, as far as, how things will look without the combine in a much different draft, I'm sure. What is your general sense for how 2021 will look as we stand right now?
Well, that's interesting. I went out to dinner at the Super Bowl with Peter King and Ben Volen from the Boston Globe, and we were talking about what events do you think will – at what point do you think we will have a semi-normal event? Will it be early in the season? Will vaccinations be to a point where we have that? Will it be, the Super Bowl? Will the Super Bowl in LA next year be sort of the coming out event in sports, the first major magnitude event where fans are back in full? Yes, California is very different. And, from the they have not done a good job with vaccination distribution. It's very locked down. I look around, especially in Northern California. I mean, this is the place where Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth had to wear masks on TV. Only city where they had to do that was Santa Clara. So, and the 49ers couldn't even play there at the end of the season. So I have a feeling that we're going to see – some resumption of what we kind of saw as normal around midway through next season and or this upcoming season, particularly with the, you know, Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which supposedly does not need to be refrigerated and might not have the efficacy of Moderna or Pfizer. You know, so maybe with a broader sort of, you know, into this fall when it feels like most people, you know, have been vaccinated, then we might see some resumption of a normal, you know. But I'll tell you, it's just being in Tampa on Friday and Saturday night and seeing large groups of people who are unmasked made me nervous. Made me nervous being in those situations. So I wonder when we're going to get back to a completely normal feeling of, hey, I'm cool with being in a huge crowd of people and having people all around me.
I can tell you from
it might take a while.
And I will say this, to quote the great David Tepper, I'm not a doctor, and Sam, I know you're not a doctor, so we'll not hold you to any of this stuff as far as forecasting.
Nor do I play one on TV. As I said, I can't believe we're talking about this stuff.
I know.
World has come to.
From your perspective.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
But I like I said, from an NFL perspective, it's fascinating to get your view. Sam Farmer, Pro Football Hall of Fame McCann Award winner, joining us here on the Roar podcast. You can find his work at latimes.com/Sam, at LA Times Farmer on Twitter. He's a great follow. You're probably following him now. If you're not, get on it. Sam, this was a thrill, man. I've been a major fan of yours for a long time. And Billy and I can't thank you enough for making time, sir. Good luck in Pebble. And hopefully if you make it to Charlotte soon, we'll catch up, man.
That sounds terrific. John, Billy, thanks so much for having me on.
Sam Farmer, LA Times, joins us here on the Roar podcast right here on Blue Wire.
The economy is made up of real people doing real stuff, and it affects everything. Which you obviously know since you're a real person doing real stuff. Marketplace is here to help you get smart about everything beyond the what of the day's business and economic news. We dig into the how and the why with the real people driving our economy. From big tech and interest rates to small businesses and what's happening at the Fed, Marketplace breaks it all down so you don't have to. Listen to Marketplace wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Roar Podcast. John Ellis, Billy Marshall with you, as we are giving you a full Super Bowl recap bonanza here. Thanks to Sam Farmer, by the way, from the LA Times for joining us. And Billy, you know, just a lot to discuss from our end, you and me here. We haven't talked in a few days. We haven't spoken since the Super Bowl. What did you think of that game? Obviously, we don't love seeing Tampa win the Super Bowl. What's up with that, man?
Yeah, no, I was DMing a few people on, you know, Thursday and Friday, and I was talking to a couple other friends, close friends of mine, who you know, are big time gamblers. They live in they don't live in Vegas, but they live like in the West Coast, and they put down a lot of money. And I was just like, hey guys, like I really feel like you know, Tampa is a really good play here, just from a betting standpoint. +3, they you know, they have the situation where they're comfortable in their own backyard. I know that they did get beat pretty badly. Well, it wasn't pretty badly. They scored some points in garbage time the first meeting, but I just felt like, despite that being garbage time, there were some things that they did that kind of exposed Kansas City's defense. And for me, that was just the biggest thing. It was like, you have a situation where the Chiefs are missing four offensive linemen. Mahomes, I was reading reports throughout the week that he was healthy, but that toe was still bothering him somewhat. And I really felt like this was an opportunity for Tampa to really take it to them. And I took the 3 points. I thought maybe Tampa could win, but I wasn't expecting it. Right. I've definitely felt Tampa plus 3 was the play. And lo and behold, it was much more worse than that for the Chiefs. It was a complete and utter beatdown. I'm sure. I mean, the refs, they weren't great, in my opinion, even if you disregard two touchdowns by the Bucks. It's still a game that it's still a game that Tampa easily handles. And I think the biggest thing for me in that game, I don't know about you, was just the way that Kansas City's defense, that was a thing that no one's really mentioning, is how poor they played. And that it's surprising, because we've seen Spagnuolo defenses really affect Brady in the past. So that was disappointing if I'm a Chiefs fan. But I mean, hey, it was it wasn't a good game, to be honest with you.
It reminded me a lot of Tampa's last Super Bowl win, Billy, back in 2003. Yeah. It had that same vibe to it.
It was like, I was going to say Seattle-Denver was another one.
Yep. It had that same feel to it. The officiating was a bit sloppy at times. I agree with you. That's a storyline. I know Mark Schofield did a piece on this, on the sort of the flip side of what you're talking about, but the same theme of what the job Tampa's offensive line did. And I think overall – they did a great job schematically commanding the game from that first touchdown drive, where they went heavy, they got the run going, they ran play action off that, they slowed down what Spags likes to do, which is bring heat and light you up. And no better way to do that than to run the ball to Fournette, pass out of big formations, hit that tight end screen, and then they run that little PA slide down there, that little RPO slide for the touchdown. That I thought that drive was crucial for everything. But, globally, I don't think Chris Jones – I mean, we talk about this guy a lot. I don't believe he's had a playoff sack in his career yet. And I know sacks aren't everything. But I was certainly not only disappointed with KC's defense, but even more impressed by the offensive line and the play calling by Leftwich and Arians. I thought just Tampa was masterful early in that game. And, of course, defensively, I'm sure we're going to get to that, the job Todd Bowles and that secondary and front seven did. Man, they're just so athletic. It's so fun to watch them on tape.
You know, it's really interesting. I thought Chris Jones actually had a really good Super Bowl a couple years ago against San Francisco, despite him not having a sack. I thought he was really effective in that game. But this game, I agree with you. I just felt like Kansas City, they just have very slow and I mean, they're not bad players. Like Kitchens and Damian, I can't forget his last name, but I know he used to play for the Cowboys. Damian Wilson. They're fine linebackers, but they're just not really athletic. And, you know, in a situation where you're going to have to guard the middle of the field against Gronk and Brate and potentially Godwin in the slot, it's just a very difficult proposition for you. So, yeah, I agree. I was very disappointed in the Chiefs' defense. But, you know, to me, I just felt like – a lot of things were in Tampa's favor, and I'm sure we'll get to it when we discuss how their offense did, the Kansas City's offense.
Yeah, no question. I guess I can sort of take you down that road now from a defensive perspective from what we saw from Tampa. I just thought from the get-go was outstanding. Now, this is no secret. We talked to John Ledyard in the preseason, Billy, or actually I think he was previewing one of the early games this season. And, we talked about Todd Bowles. You and I have been talking about Todd's defense for 2 years now, particularly in the run game, and how good they are, how stout they are with Vitavea, with Sue, JPP. But in terms of some of the things I saw on tape, and again, I'm not a maestro in terms of tape study, but I know enough of what I'm looking at to see, man, some of these games they ran up front were outstanding. And the thing that stood out to me, not only that, but Lavonte David matched up, one-on-one on Kelsey. And then the secondary in general, how aggressive and effective they were crashing down on these routes. The tape was so fun to watch from that perspective. It's not fun if you're a Panthers fan, obviously, but from a football perspective, I just thought they were so well synchronized in that game, Billy.
Yeah, totally. I just felt like they knew what they were doing. And I mean, I really do feel for the Chiefs, and I feel for Remmers. I mean, he's not a left tackle. He even, on the right side, he was very serviceable, replacing an all pro in Mitchell Schwartz.
Yeah, he had a good year.
Very good year for a swing tackle. He was really good as a backup, but when you move him to the left side, that's just it's asking for trouble. And it's nothing against Remmers. It's just like, run out of bodies.
Quickly on that, I want to make a point that, no, it's nothing personal with Remmers. The Panthers know the story with this guy. He's given up a lot of pressures in two Super Bowls. And honestly, it's just a matter of injuries and running out of healthy bodies at this point. In Carolina's situation, it was just a bad matchup. So what are you going to do? He's not exactly a first-round blue-chip guy. He is who he is, and this is what happens when Mike Remmers plays left tackle against that defense.
Yeah, totally. It was tough. And then I think the biggest, team-building thing that really kind of stuck out to me, with regards to Tampa's, personnel and defense, is they consistently, since Jason Light has been there, invested in the secondary. And that's included some high-profile misses. They drafted Vernon Hargraves, top 10 in 2016, and he turned out to be a bust. Right. But they stuck with their philosophy. They drafted MJ Stewart, another guy very high in the second round. He turned out to be a bust for them. But they stuck again to their philosophy. They drafted Carlton Davis, Jamel Dean, Murphy Bunting, Winfield, Whitehead, Mike Edwards, I think he's still on their team. So they just, you have to really appreciate that sort of conviction in your process on team building. And that's something that really, not just Carolina, but any team could use moving forward.
Yeah, Carlton Davis, Jamel Dean, Winfield Jr., of course, now becomes part of a father-son duo now that has intercepted balls in the postseason, which I think is fascinating. Mike Edwards with an effective season at times, Jordan Whitehead. Yeah, I mean, look, they and we've seen this team twice this year now. And what stands out to me, not only in terms of the team building on defense, but just how they peaked at the right time. And I know some people don't buy into that. They think that's, garbage, that everything is random in this league. But Belichick has always said, and I don't think it's, without merit, that the best teams start to play their best ball after Thanksgiving. And we saw what happened with this team at 7-5. They ran the table. We've seen other teams do this in the past. We've seen a team in the Panthers do this at one time in 2003. They ran the table all the way to the Super Bowl just like this. So I just thought that was an interesting dynamic. And I go back to what Tom Brady does for this entire deal. Now there's a storyline out there, of course, that's just it gets tiring after a while, that he's the GOAT and wins and this and that, and we all know how great he is. We all know Belichick got contributions as well, so I'm not interested in that debate. But give me your perspective on Tom Brady's intangible impact on this team from day one. How much of that do you buy into in terms of what he was able to do, not only just from a leadership perspective, but just giving them the confidence to go forward? Or was it just a matter of better execution and less turnovers?
It's interesting. it's a very multi-layered kind of discussion, I feel like, because while Brady played fine, I mean, he was good. I wouldn't say he was, in my opinion, he was not the best player in Tampa's offense. I would give credit to the offensive line and Gronk in particular. Those, they really stood out to me before Brady. But I mean, I the stuff I read and, I hear from trusted reporters, they obviously say that the intangibles make a huge impact. And I mean, I don't think anyone disagrees that Brady, from an intangible point of view, is probably the greatest quarterback ever. It's some of the other stuff that kind of you have to judge him for, but it's really important, I guess, if that's, something that they've missed throughout, their 20 odd years, not being in the playoffs since, they won the Super Bowl, whatever. It's intangibles are huge at the quarterback position. You have to make sure that you have a quarterback who's not only a leader, but holds, first of all, himself accountable, and then from there, he can command the respect and hold everyone else accountable. So I don't know if that, it's something that's really hard for us on the outside to judge too, if you know what I mean.
No, I totally agree. And I brought that to your attention because I, as much as anybody out there, I appreciate your viewpoint on these things, because I think we get sucked into the quarterback wins vortex on the mainstream media in terms of how ESPN looks at this. And what you and I have always tried to do, I think, is look at this from a multi-layer perspective. And sometimes it takes a little time to peel back those layers. I'll just say, you know, look, you can look at his second half of that Green Bay game and you see three picks on the board. He's in Jake Delhomme territory at that point. But, you know, to be honest, and then there's a call at the end of that game that you and I talked about that will live in infamy for Green Bay fans for in Aaron Rodgers' mind for a long time. The defensive holding call. But I do think that, you know, from everything I've heard from interviews this week from players, and I think they're genuine. I've heard Ryan Succop talk about this, Jadon Mickens, some other low-level guys you don't hear about a lot. Tom comes in. He knows your name right away. He doesn't treat you like, you know, he's a diva. And I think that people need to understand that most star quarterbacks, I think, probably treat their teammates that way. He's just better than everybody else in terms of his mind processing and his ability to get things done in pressure situations. Now, they built a lead in this game, obviously. He threw for 201 yards, three touchdowns. And I just thought, Billy, in the second half, just I guess we can touch on Kansas City's offense and then do a little Carolina chatter here before we head on out. I thought that the Mahomes stuff, I saw some incompletions from him that were better than some completions I've seen in Carolina over the past 2 years. What he can do athletically, of course, is remarkable. But I just thought they had an opportunity in that game to get some of their other receivers involved early on. That's how I viewed it. I viewed it, you know, I know Watkins was active. I guess I thought he'd have somewhat of a role like he did in the Super Bowl against San Fran. That was not the case. You know, they have some other options as well. Hardman was barely a part of the mix there. So I just think they missed a few opportunities. And I felt that Tampa at times sort of did that Belichick thing where, okay, we'll let you run a little bit between the 20s. We'll give you some yards, but when it comes down to the red zone, hey, we're going to clamp down and know what you're going to do. What were your thoughts on Bieniemy and Reed's game plan? Do you think there were any flaws in that in terms of protection or play calling?
Yeah, it's so easy to play Monday morning quarterback. First of all, I'm not accusing you of doing that. I know you don't, you're probably one of the guys who usually doesn't do that. Twitter in general. That's why I've kind of just I'm waiting for this week to kind of finish so I can hop back on and give my unfiltered
love it
takes. But no, seriously, it's. To be quite frank with you, I've watched every single game Mahomes has played this year. I felt like that was one of his best games. And from a production standpoint, obviously, it's not going to show that. I know there were a lot of people disappointed in him for whatever reason. But it's just really tough to construct a functional NFL offense when you're missing so much talent at the in the offensive line.
Yeah.
Now, look, they tried to mitigate those by having throwing screens to their running backs, but Tampa, they have some really long and athletic edge rushers. So JPP was able to get his hand on a couple. Shaq Barrett and their linebackers were able to come over the top and prevent any screens from happening. So they tried that. I mean, they tried their regular game plan, but Tampa was very smart to play their safeties deep this time so they don't give up those situations that in the first game where Tyreek Hill had like 200 yards in the first quarter. So it was very difficult. And just in general, everyone's making a big deal out of the edge rushers, but the interior of their offensive line got exposed a few times, not just from Vita Vea, but Sue had a decent game. Raheem Nunez-Rocious had a decent game. So it was just a reckoning. And it kind of reminded me in some aspects of Carolina's Super Bowl against Denver.
Oh, most certainly.
It just like you have a very talented quarterback doing pretty much everything he can to will his team to victory. And again, I thought Mahomes, he battled, he played his butt off. There is no one on that team that I think deserves any type of negativity, especially him.
And the discourse has been disgusting on that, by the way. And, you know, that's going to happen after these games. But just some of these meatheads you hear on Sports Talk or, you know, on Twitter. Twitter can be such a hellscape, as our friend Mark Scofield calls it. And for anybody with a brain in their head to look at Mahomes and say that, oh, you know, here we go in a big game. This is what you get. You got to peel back the layers here. Obviously, you and I know that. There were some major deficiencies with their offensive line. And they ran into a buzzsaw, Billy.
They just did. I mean, they kept, you know, friends of I were watching that game and they kept saying, well, this is the Mahomes rally. We've seen it. And I just kept saying to myself, guys, I can feel the flow of this game. It ain't going to happen. This is too dominant of a defense and they're in too much control on offense to piss this thing away.
It really did kind of remind me of 2015 Super Bowl.
Absolutely. And here's the testament to that. Carolina was in that game with 7 minutes left.
I think that's partially because Denver's offense was so bad.
That's my point. Denver's offense only relied on basically a couple passes here and there to the tight end, and then the C.J. Anderson had a nice game, but Peyton Manning was atrocious. I mean, he threw a pick to Coney Ealy for crying out loud.
So, I remember that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Coney, you know, if they had won, Coney could have won the MVP, Billy. He had like a strip sack and a pick. But, yeah, Manning was brutal, and Brady's obviously playing at a much higher level right now than that. And Tampa obviously is an all-star team right now. I mean, they got Antonio Brown playing at a high level again, Gronk out of retirement and in good form, Godwin and Evans. I mean, this is just – if you're looking at the NFC South, we can shift to Carolina here. Obviously, from a NFC South global perspective, folks have said, well, you know, the window's closing, you know, obviously with New Orleans. And, yeah, they're in a different situation than Tampa in many ways. They're much different. Atlanta's got a mess on their hands, I think, in terms of Ryan and in the salary cap and what they have to do. But they have an intriguing staff they're building. And now Carolina's sort of in this tween zone where, you know, we're trying to get Stafford. We hate that we signed Bridgewater. I mean, I think they do because they're trying to get rid of him in year two. And Tampa, all of a sudden, with Brady, you know, barely getting touched, might play for a few more years. So as you look at the landscape of this division right now, I guess my question would be, where do you see Carolina in the mix moving forward, at least in the short term?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. But at the same time, there's so much offseason to go. Now, if I'm just looking at it today, obviously Carolina has to address some of their weaknesses, whatever they are. I'll let people decide that. We've gone over that in depth on previous shows. But for me, I think New Orleans is getting a little underrated here because, you know, we can obviously mourn the loss in a good way of Drew Brees. But, I mean, whatever we feel about Taysom Hill or Jameis Winston, I mean, Sean Payton is like an excellent coach. I mean, they went 5-0 with Teddy last year, and then this year they were what, 3-1 with Taysom. So he's gone 8-1.
He got Teddy paid 33 guaranteed. I mean, how good Sean is.
You know, it's funny because I remember that. Then I go back to 2015 when they came to Charlotte week 3, and they had Luke McCown thrown all over the place. And right. If it wasn't for a Josh Norman like insane interception,
they're
winning that game. So I never underestimate Sean Payton. I mean, you could throw, you know, a 50-year-old Jake DeLone back there, and I still feel like they'll have
I'd love to see that. That'd be fun.
Jake,
real quickly, just let me say this about Sean Payton. I'm going to let you finish here. I've studied his career for a long time. I know you have too. And there's a love-hate relationship with Panthers fans. I've taken kind of my fan hat off for that because I know he rubs a lot of people the wrong way. But in terms of his presence as a coach, his influences from the Parcells tree, working under some great coaches of his own, and getting just, you know, I've read about his relationship with Parcells and what he wanted to bring in terms of toughness, running the football, being a physical team on both sides in the trenches. But then the innovation stuff, Parcells has talked about that, how Sean was able to branch out what his standards were and to create his own thing in terms of the passing tree, the innovation side of the passing game. But I will say this, as long as Sean is there, they're a perennial 10-win team because they've got that defense set to the
top. Yeah, I agree.
And whoever plays quarterback next, I think will be an upgrade from what they've seen from Brees. I really do.
And they might trade a couple guys. I think Michael Thomas is probably the one guy that I'd keep an eye on if they trade because he has a big deal and we saw some of his flaws exposed. And I think there's a little bit of tension in that organization between – the two sides, and then this goes back a long way. Back in last offseason, there were some issues with, especially as it came with the social justice, back in June. So I just keep an eye, I feel like, on that situation. This isn't me like breaking any rumors. I've read a few other reporters suggest that maybe Thomas is a guy that could be moved because they got to pay some guys too, like Trey Hendrickson. He's probably a guy like that they're going to allow to walk, but they got to pay Marshawn Lattimore. And Atlanta, for me, I don't know what to expect. I mean, it seems like they're going through a rebuilding situation, but they still have Matt Ryan and Julio Jones. So I don't know. They're a fascinating team to watch this offseason, especially at the quarterback position, what they do in the draft. And then, yeah, I mean, Tampa's like, Godwin's a free agent, but I mean, outside of that, it seems like they have their team pretty much intact.
Joe Person wrote Joe, by the way, has done some great work, I think, this offseason in terms of giving us the lay of the land as far as scenarios. But Carolina has 21 pending free agents on the roster. You've got Taylor Moten, Curtis Samuel, F.A. Obata, who's restricted. John Miller's unrestricted. As you look at what they have ahead of them from a retention standpoint, obviously Moten comes to mind. Where can this team go in terms of who they have on the roster right now, and where can they get better, not only from within, but maybe from the outside, trades aside, Billy?
So I read a piece from Jeremy Fowler on ESPN. I know, I think you cited that piece this week too, if I'm not mistaken. And the first name I wanted to find was Taylor Moten, obviously, because he's one of our own players, and he's one of the best right tackles in the NFL, in my opinion.
Yes.
And, you know, Fowler is a pretty good reporter, but he did say in that article that he expects Carolina to either come to a long-term deal or to franchise tag Moten. So that's pretty encouraging news. So we'll see what they do. And
the franchise is estimated to be around $13.6 million right now, as it's reported by Joe Person in the
Athletic. That's pretty cheap.
Yeah, I think that would be for what he gives you, right? Absolutely. And I don't know if that doesn't really solve your issue at left tackle necessarily. But, I mean, we've talked about teams, Billy. I mean, look at Tampa. Look at these other teams that have two rock-solid options. Look at, you know, what's going on in Baltimore now with Orlando Brown. You know, they've got two very good options there at tackle, and one now wants out, reportedly, because he feels like he's a left tackle and wants a fresh start. Mm-hmm. Carolina needs to make sure going in they at least have one rock-solid tackle to start next season, and they've got one on Moten on the roster. So I think you're right. They need to get that locked up there. Where do you think Curtis is heading? Do you think he's coming back?
Yeah, I think Curtis Samuel is probably going to be the odd man out here. And that's obviously a situation that I hope doesn't happen. I hope he returns, but I'm just kind of playing the numbers and just, I feel like it's a numbers game at this point. And I feel like Samuel, for what he produced this year, is going to be, in demand, and I feel like he's going to have a pretty strong market, and I don't think Carolina is going to be able to afford that. Obviously, I wish they could, but I'm not sure I see him returning. And I mean, the others, I'm not really sure anyone else excites me, because I'm sure you can bring a few of these guys back on a minimum deal or a 1-year deal, maybe even. But yeah, I think Moten has to be the priority, and if there's a situation where you can bring back Samuel, then that would be very encouraging to me.
Let's face it. Samuel has been one of the better vertical guys in the league and has gone unrewarded for that for 2 or 3 years now, Billy, because of some really inadequate quarterback play, even with Newton with his shoulder and then with Kyle Allen and again with what happened this year with Bridgewater. I just think Curtis is going to thrive in a system that lets him, you know, go vertical and somebody that can give him the damn ball. And unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be here.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. I think Jacksonville is probably an ideal situation for him because Urban Meyer recruited him.
Right.
And I think they're probably looking to, they have a lot of cap space as well. So it's not like Carolina can compete with teams like the Jaguars or the Jets when it comes to cap space this offseason. And those teams are going to be using it, I'm sure.
I think that gets to my point as we kind of wrap things up here with Deshaun Watson. We still don't know much about that situation. All we know is the team is in somewhat of a spiral still. Their team president resigned today, and obviously he was reportedly frustrated with the process. So it's not just Deshaun here. There's a narrative out there that Watson's taking a wrecking ball to his teammates, and this is a bad way of going about business. And I just don't agree with that, Billy. I just think this is a very uniquely dysfunctional situation that merits Watson taking ownership of his future. And I don't blame him one bit. Now, will he land in Carolina? I have my doubts about that. I just, yeah, because here's the thing, Bill, they're at number 8 in the draft. They don't have a blue chip top 3 pick that gets you one of those guys. And I don't know if that's a great lead-in for that trade package. Obviously, they have McCaffrey. They have some other vets that would be enticing. But I just, from a Watson perspective, I'm going to kind of leave it at that for right now. There's other names out there. I'll turn to the draft, though, Billy. No combine this year. There's going to be pro days and workouts, and I'm sure we'll see some news from those. But just right now, as we sit here in the middle of February, do you have a general sense of where Carolina might turn their attention in the draft?
Yeah, it's so tough to tell, John, because, you know, we're sitting February 10th, and there's so much – usually there's so much process that has to go through,
right.
Like the combine, like pro days, like private visits, private workouts – and then all the phone calls and security information that you got to do. By security, I mean like investigation, make sure they're off field.
Right.
Issues are clean. I don't know. I really don't. I'm still going to go with what I said during our Senior Bowl episode. I think Carolina, because they didn't trade, if they do keep the number 8 pick, which with Stafford off the board, I think they probably will. And they're probably going to use it to trade up for one of these QBs. That's what I see happening now. Which QB that is, I don't know at this stage of the process.
You have any interest in Carson Wentz whatsoever?
No.
Okay, good. I agree with you.
No, thank you.
That contract is not fun to look at, and he's been hurt. He's hurt himself with his back. He's had some ups and downs, and I don't want to touch that. I really don't. I don't think you're moving forward with that.
Yeah, Bill Voth and Joe Person kind of threw some hints out there that Carolina's not really involved in that.
Yeah, that's the sentiment I'm thinking too, just from reading those guys, and they're much more in the loop than we are. But you just, you know, these things can come up and sneak up on you. You never know. You know, the Sam Darnold stuff, you just don't know. That's names out. It's going to be fascinating. That's why I said a couple weeks ago, buckle up, kids. It's going to be a hell of a few weeks and a couple months, really, with the Sean situation. Very likely, you know, it could resolve itself before the draft, or maybe not. It's hard to tell where they are right now in terms of their thinking. I'll just say this once again, that Carolina, you need a quarterback. But you got some time to get it done right. And I'd hate for them, with the Stafford thing comes to mind, Billy, you and I talked about this, I'd hate for them to just go balls out right now and mortgage too much for a guy that's not worth it. Watson's the only guy I'd do that for, because he's 25 and he's a top 5 guy.
I don't get – whatever. It's just very confusing to me what the urgency is.
Well, that's – no, it's a valid discussion, Billy. I mean, we haven't talked about this at length. Is this a fitterer thing all of a sudden? You know, hey, what we heard from Matt and Dave in year one was just getting to know each other, and they didn't know how to message this thing, so let's set a low bar. And now fitterer comes in, and they recalibrate their plans. That's the feeling I get, that, okay, you know what? All of a sudden – the market conditions changed. Watson is suddenly reportedly available. So is Stafford. And – Tepper, we talked to Joe Person, Billy. He said this about Tepper, and I've talked about this too, that Tepper doesn't want to continue to lose games. So I think this patience thing sounded good in the beginning, but I always had my doubts as to whether or not they could follow that blueprint. Had they traded for Stafford, that had catastrophic ramifications potentially, and that's nothing against Stafford. But the fact that they were that close to getting that done, I still shake my head at that.
What's the plan?
I mean, what –
it just, like, how does Stafford fit into a Joe Brady offense that's not really like predicated on a lot of under center drop back play action vertical? To me, I don't know. It's going to be fascinating to just watch what they do. And, you know, trading for a Stafford or Wentz doesn't make sense at all. Even trading for Darnold doesn't. I mean, if it's Darnold for like a third round pick, fine, whatever. Like, I can stomach that, but
that doesn't excite me. That's, you know, and
I agree.
You know, these top three quarterbacks in this draft all have a unique skill set, and then you've got Lance there. I don't know if you agree with this, but I think those are clearly the top four guys in this draft in terms of the quarterback position. Wilson, Lance, Fields, and then, of course, Lawrence. I honestly just – the more I hear and read about Mac Jones, I've seen enough of him to know what you're getting with him. And I don't think that's the right path either. I don't think trading back or – something people have suggested to me on the radio – I was on a talk show the other day. Billy said, would you draft Mac Jones at 8? I said, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Mac Jones in the second round is fine, but
yeah, I mean, sure, but not top 15. No.
Yeah, it's. You're getting Garoppolo'd.
You're getting Garoppolo'd if you do that. You're back in that cycle.
Yeah, I mean, Garoppolo in the second round is a fine value on a rookie contract, but in the top eight, it's no. Just trade up for one of the top, the other three quarterbacks who is Trevor Lawrence. And if you don't feel comfortable with one of those, then just take the best player available or trade down and get more assets and continue building your team. I don't understand the time crunch here. You're given like a 7-year contract. You're not given like a 3-year contract.
I appreciate the fact that they want to win. I get it, but they have the real potential to build this thing lopsided if they go too heavy in on quarterback and they don't build everything else proper around it. Because let's be honest, this defense, as inspired as it was, Billy, and I thought Phil Snow did a great job, they're razor thin. They have no depth. I mean, especially –
glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, I mean, they're so thin. Obviously, they need another corner opposite of Dante, but they got to get some depth, Billy. That's one of their biggest things right now.
No, I'm glad you mentioned it, John. And that, again, this team – it's not one position away. Now, yes, the franchise quarterback certainly masks issues in other areas of the offense, but you just continue to build your team. Be patient. Like, you guys are, you know, consistently mentioning, you know, taking a long-term view and mentioning the words process. And I mean, what does this process do when you're just consistently making these short-term acquisitions?
I said the same thing last offseason. The Bridgewater signing, the way they went about that and the way they, you know, they signed Robbie Anderson, it was a half a tank. It was like, okay, we want to be competitive. We want to win some games here with some veterans. But they paid Teddy Bridgewater $33 million guaranteed for 5 wins in New Orleans. That's what they paid for. Nothing else on – Billy, you've seen his tape in Minnesota too. I mean, look, it's not just the late game comeback stuff. It takes a unit to do that. It's not just all in the quarterback. But some of the limitations there. So that right away was a red flag to me that, okay, this – Evan Cooper reportedly, and this is in an article, said, hey, if you ever go to the NFL, Teddy Bridgewater is the guy you got to go get. And they went and got him. And I don't know what the marketplace was for Teddy. I don't know who else was willing to pay him a 3-year deal worth that much with an opt-out in the third year. But red flags came up there. And now these are more red flags when you start doubling back on what was a very, to me, it was a very cogent plan in terms of we're going young on defense. We're going to build patiently. But like I said, Billy, and I'll close out with this, anything this owner has said, anything this coach has said before the hire of Scott Fitter, I'm putting a bit of an asterisk beside it because, honestly, I think it's a bit of a reset now. I really do.
Yeah. Let's see. And obviously, rumors are rumors and reports are reports, but until these moves are made, I want to see how they pivot in this situation.
Yeah. It'll be fascinating. We will be back with you guys next week. We've got a special guest coming up, scheduled right now for our Tuesday show, Stephen Ruiz from For the Win, USA Today, one of their best analysts. I know Billy loves his work, has been interacting with him for a while, and I've gotten to know Stephen a little bit on Twitter here recently, and he's always a fun follow. So Stephen's going to hop on with us, and he's followed this Carolina saga too, Billy, so I'm sure he's going to have some thoughts on where they are right now. Once again, we appreciate you guys. Thanks to Sam Farmer, LA Times, for joining us. For Billy Marshall, this is John Ellis. Thanks again for listening to The Roar on Blue Wire. See you next time.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.